never doubt your decision, and never look back and say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Just keep going, because you can't change it. So therefore, you should just make sure that you keep thinking of it in that positive way. And it's, I think it's almost human nature to not change. But there are so many exciting opportunities if you just keep yourself open to change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Redefining Ambition. I'm your host, Jamie Vinnick, founder and president of the Women's Network, the largest collegiate women's networking organization in the United States. Today, I'm so excited to welcome Dr. Ellen Senske, the president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum, Wisconsin's Museum of Natural History. Dr. Senske is an acclaimed biologist, author of several books, and the pioneer of the internationally adopted BioBlitz program, which is now a staple community outreach venture at institutions in every single U.S. state and in countries around the world. Her work has even landed her on the front page of the New York Times. Her career has taken many twists, and after leading museums in Connecticut and Oklahoma, she decided to return home to Milwaukee. In this episode, Dr. Senske discusses how the BioBlitz program inspired young scientists to pursue interest in the field, shares stories about some of her research trips, and highlights the importance of keeping an open mind and maintaining curiosity about, quote, our amazing planet. Hope you enjoy the episode, and make sure to follow us on Instagram at thewomens.network and at Redefining Ambition.
I am so excited to welcome Dr. Ellen Senske to the podcast. Welcome to Redefining Ambition.
I'm excited to be here.
So excited to have you. Is this your first podcast episode?
It is. Yeah, I believe it is.
Okay.
So you have a first.
Yes, I do. Yay, that's exciting. We have so much to cover. You have this incredible career. Listeners, I was telling, I'm going to refer to you as Ellen earlier, that you've accomplished so much and there are so many lessons to draw on. I'm really excited to have this conversation. So I want to begin by understanding more about your upbringing, your background. You grew up with a huge family. You're one of the younger siblings. You're also over 6 feet tall, which is a fun fact. So the listeners can visualize this since we're on a podcast. So before you went off to college where you studied zoology, you, I'm sure, had an interest in nature and sciences and STEM. So I would love for you to share more about your upbringing, your background, and early influences.
Sure. So I did grow up in a large family. I have 6 brothers and 1 sister. And, you know, I mean, I'm not ashamed to say I'm 66 years old. So growing up, that was growing up in a different time when you basically, especially in the summers, your mom said, just go out and play and come back for lunch. And so we were always in, I grew up in a small town and we were always running around. And because I had 6 brothers, I was running around with the boys. And my neighborhood was full of boys. So I was pretty much just part of the group of boys in running around and playing. So we were doing all the boy things like building forts and going exploring in the woods and going to the creek to see what we could find. And I think all of that, plus our family vacations, being in a large family with not a lot of money, we'd do camping for a vacation, and we'd go get up early and go fishing and catch sunfish and bring them home. And I mean, bring them back to camp and make them for breakfast. And so I think all of that just really solidified my love of nature and the natural world, and wanted to do something in that area. So that kind of set me off on my journey towards where I am today.
Ooh, interesting. And you grew up in a small town in Wisconsin.
Correct. Cedarburg, Wisconsin, which is about 30 miles north of Milwaukee. Got it. Close to Milwaukee, but at that time it seemed a long, long way away.
Yes. Also, I come from a family of huge Wisconsin fans. My sister goes to University of Wisconsin, Madison. So,
great.
Yes. So huge fan over here. Okay. So I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but you go off to UW Milwaukee.
Correct.
And you study zoology. You thought you wanted to be a veterinarian. You ended up deciding against that, but developed these interests in the nature and sciences and really honed in on that. So I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but you end up pursuing your PhD in biology from University of Pittsburgh, and you had some of the most fascinating research, absolutely fascinating. So I want to talk about that. You were probably one of very few women in your program, I'm guessing, to earn a PhD in the sciences.
You know, there were a few of us, but my area of expertise is amphibians and reptiles. And there were not very many women in the field of studying amphibians and reptiles, so herpetology. I do remember that I was, my very first national meeting that I went to, you know, there were very few of us, and it was down in Oklahoma. And then I believe it was 20 years later, I was in Oklahoma as the director of a museum on the campus, and we were hosting that same meeting. And I remember looking out across the room and seeing that half the people in the room were women. And it was like in that 20 years, we had really come on, and women now were really infused into all the sciences. So I didn't feel like I was the only one there, in that I did have another woman who was getting her PhD she was doing lab work. So, but yeah, there weren't many of us, and especially in the field of herpetology.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, thinking about the time where you went to school and there weren't many other women in your program to today, where more progress has been made, a lot of these programs are diversifying the people who are earning advanced degrees in many of these programs. What are some of the behaviors or patterns that you've noticed that, even though all this progression that has been achieved that we've made, there are still some key barriers that really just have not changed?
Well, I think that probably pay is one of the biggest ones. And in that women still lag far behind men in pay for, you know, equal pay. The other is, you know, because women are the ones who bear the children, they often, during that time period of time, they're either having to do double and triple the work in order to stay even with their male colleagues, or they drop out for a while and then they've lost some ground. And I think figuring out how we can handle, you know, the pay thing is a no-brainer, and there shouldn't be any discrepancy in pay. But figuring out how to allow women to actually continue to achieve, but not be so stressed out by it, that's the biggest one to me, that we have to figure out. How do you do that and still keep women in that workforce and achieving their dreams, which equals not just having that family, which is a dream, but also having their careers.
Mm. Yeah, I wanna get to more of that. So in your doctorate program, this is fascinating, this research I'm referring to, I want to touch on this. You studied sexual selection in lizards and spent 4 summers tracking a group of male lizards and documenting how the biggest ones, those that could fight off competition, mated with the most females. What did you find in a lot of that research? Can you elaborate on that and maybe the intersections or the parallels between your work there and your work in the workplace?
Sure. So the research was really looking at most reptiles and amphibians. Females are larger than males in most species. And that is because females, the bigger you are, the more eggs you can carry inside your body. because the idea is put a lot of eggs out there and hopefully they will hatch and turn into a lot of offspring. But the more you put out, the more likely some will survive. So there is this evolutionary push towards large female body size. But then there are some where the males are larger. And in general, with those where the males are larger, it's because those males maintain a territory and they have access to all the females in that territory, and they patrol that territory and they defend that territory. And so the bigger you are, the better you are at defending that territory. So therefore, that pushes male body size to be larger. But in the group of lizards that I was looking at, they are non-territorial. So I was trying to figure out, why would these males be bigger then? And it turns out in this group, the males actually guard the females. They don't guard the territory. They guard the female. And when a female is receptive, it's really interesting. They sit by that female all day. The female is feeding. And, you know, that's pretty much all they do all day is feed. So the female feeds. If she's not guarded by a male, her behavior is such that she has to constantly be looking around for predators. So she digs a little and then looks up and around and digs a little. But if she's being guarded by a male, she just eats. She doesn't, because the male is the one watching for predators. So if a male all of a sudden suddenly moves, she'll look up. But otherwise, she's eating, therefore taking in more nutrition. The males are foregoing feeding during that time. They mate with her just before she goes down in her burrow at night, and then they're there, then they cover up the burrow. And then when she comes out in the morning, they mate with her again. So again, making sure that they're the only ones with access to her. And they battle off other males. And they get into vicious fights where they tear skin. And so it turns out that in this study site that I was, where I was studying, of all of those that were, I think I had over 100 individuals marked, and the three largest males actually inseminated 84% of all the females in that, on that site. So that was really pushing male body size. And it was this thing where you got to be big in order to mate and pass on your offspring. So it was really interesting. I don't know that it relates to the human species, as in, I mean, you know, obviously I'm taller than average. I guess the way it relates is I feel like because I'm tall, I don't have to push as hard to, I feel like that when you're tall, you somehow, I don't feel as vulnerable on the street as some of my friends who are shorter. I feel like, and maybe it's just because my mom always told me, stand up straight, you know, and because I'm sure as a tall kid, when all your friends are shorter, especially the guys are shorter, you want to. So I feel like maybe my height, being an above average woman, is an advantage and it might be an advantage even in, I don't know, maybe it could be an advantage in getting a job, is, you know, leading an organization that you, which is really unfortunate because that's not the way it should be. So I don't know that the research relates directly to the workplace, but it's really interesting.
It was groundbreaking research. This was huge. This was a huge finding at the time. Was there anything other components to the research that you discovered? I'm so fascinated by it.
Well, it's interesting because there was one of the islands. So I was working on the island of Anguilla. There was a little island that was about 5 miles off Anguilla called Dog Island. And same species of lizard, but the males and females were the same size. And I wondered, well, what is driving that? And so I did camping by myself, you know, alone on a deserted island for a number of summers too, to try to figure out what was going on there. And it turns out that with that group of lizards, there's competition for food. And so on the island of Anguilla, there's a lot of food. And so males, even though they're foregoing feeding while they're guarding females, once they're done guarding, it's easy to find food and they can regenerate. And when you're big, that big size, and you're not an organism that has to maintain a certain temperature, you can forego feeding for a period of time. When you're smaller, it's harder to forego feeding. So in this one, what sparked it with me was my very first night on the island all by myself, you know, hearing about drug runners, because that's why they didn't want me on the island, was the government of Anguilla was worried they couldn't patrol out that far. And it was an island that where drug runners would drop off drugs, and then they'd drop it off. And then there had been planes that would fly in and pick it up and then take it up to the US. Well, so they were a little concerned about that. So they gave me a radio so that I could be in contact with them if I needed, though I had to go to the tallest point on the island in order to use the radio. But anyway, my first night, I, you know, crawl into my tent and fall asleep. And all of a sudden I have this dream, which I didn't realize was a dream. So in my dream, I have light shining in my eyes and there's people all around the tent and I'm thinking drug runners. And I wake up and realize the light shining in my eyes is the moonlight coming through the tent flap. And the people all around are hermit crabs. And the island was just filled with hermit crabs that come out and scavenge all night. And there were so many of them that I started thinking, and the environment was very different. It didn't have the same, you know, anything that would fall. If a fruit fell, the hermit crabs were right on it. And so I started thinking, well, maybe food is what's a limiting factor. And that's the case, is that males cannot forego feeding in order to guard females. So they may be sticking around females, but they'll go off and feed. And when they go off and feed, another young little male will come in and mate with the female. And so they don't guard, they're eating. And so that is what's keeping their body size down, is they just can't. They're not the only ones who are mating with the females. It's all of them who are.
Wow. I'm sure people are also wondering, did you get pinched?
Yes, just once.
That must be very painful.
Yeah, actually, the lizards, I had to one time, the lizards, when they would bite, they would clamp down and you couldn't get them to open their mouth. And so one time I had to go into the ocean and put them underwater in order for them to open their mouth. So the lizard was a little more painful.
Oh my gosh. Wow. You say that so casually.
Well, you know, it's part of the job. It wasn't like it, what it had happened is it had just grabbed onto the side of my finger. So it wasn't like it was clamped onto the whole side. It was just grabbed onto the side, but it would not release. So a little dunking in water made it release. So,
wow. So you earned your doctorate, this huge accomplishment. You became Dr. Ellen Sensky. You graduated from University of Pittsburgh and you took a job at the Carnegie Museum and worked there for a number of years. And you accomplished so many incredible things there, one of which being this program that you piloted at the time that has since been adapted across tons of institutions, not just in this country, but across the world, which is absolutely incredible. And it's called BioBlitz. So can you speak more to this program that you developed?
Sure. So this was back in the 90s. And the Carnegie Museum of Natural History is a large institution with a lot of scientists in it who do research on all kinds of natural history. There had just been, the Carnegie Science Center had just opened in Pittsburgh, and everybody in the community thought that the scientists were at the Science Museum and they didn't know what the Natural History Museum did. And so one of the botanists had actually seen in DC, there was a group of scientists who had done a 24-hour inventory of one of the parks in the NDC, and they just posted what they found on it. And she saw that, and she and I were talking, and we said, well, why don't we do this, but let's invite the public to come in and see what we're doing. And so the BioBlitz is a 24-hour biological inventory of an urban park. That's my view, is it should be urban, because the thing that I love about it is it introduces people to the biodiversity in your own backyard, because we think about biodiversity as being in the woods or in the rainforests, or and it's actually right in your own backyard. So what we did was we would start the program at 3 on a Friday, run it to 3 on a Saturday, and invite the public to come in like all day Saturday. We have a base camp set up where all of the scientists who've been out across the park will come in. They'll do identifications in there. You got a bunch of botanists and entomologists who are sitting at microscopes identifying stuff. The public gets to interact with them. We had our educators there talking about what we were doing and even taking people out. We encourage people to go out and find, we always wore t-shirts that identified us, find the scientists and just tag along with them and see what they're doing. And then at the end, at 3 o'clock, I said, well, we have to make this a big show at the end. So we would always do a countdown to the, I always started it with a starter gun and ended it with a starter gun, because it was a race to see how many species we could find in 24 hours. And so we would, you know, play it up and ask the public to step out of the tent as the, you know, the final 15 minutes as the scientists are scurrying around. And then we would announce the numbers at the end. And it's always amazing in that, you know, we're coming up with numbers that are in the hundreds and thousands in that time, in the 24-hour time period. So it really, it drives home that we've got a lot of biodiversity everywhere on this planet, and hopefully it gets kids excited about science. I do remember our first BioBlitz in Connecticut. It was in a park that had a housing development along the edge of it, and there it was a neighborhood that loved this park, and they really, so we engaged the neighborhood in it. And I remember this little kid who was probably about 10 years old, had probably never, ever looked through a microscope before. He spent like 2 hours with the parasitologist who was looking through, it was a woman, she was looking through roadkill for parasites. So 10-year-old boy, what couldn't he love about this? The goriness of, and she's finding parasites with him. And he was, I mean, he spent, like I said, 2 hours with him. And in the end, he gave her a big hug and said, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And you knew this kid never had been exposed to something like that, didn't even know. And you hope that what they did was set him off on a course that maybe changed his life and made him think, maybe I can do that. And so, you know, I think that's the biggest thing that I see that the BioBlitz does, is it engages, especially when we do them in urban parks. I mean, this was a park where the police showed up. They patrolled around the outside because it was in a tough neighborhood. And they, at the very end, they said, well, did you find any dead bodies in there? And we said, no. And they said, oh, okay. Well, we had an informant say there was one in there. We figured you guys would find it. So, and that's the kind of parks I wanted to go into to show that there's biodiversity everywhere. You may just think that it's a couple of trees and grass, but there's a diversity of life in those parks.
Wow. I mean, a huge part of it, which you touched on, is that it's a way for the public to become more informed, also for young people to feel and be inspired. Did you hear any stories across the country of people participating, other than the one you just shared, people participating and that leading to other events in their life?
To careers? You know, I haven't actually heard. I know that these take place around the world now. In fact, we started doing them, and I started getting, National Geographic covered it and did an hour-long program on it. And that then sparked all kinds of inquiries on how do you do this. So I produced a guide to doing it, and that then sparked them. I haven't personally heard any. I do know that the scientists who get involved love doing it, because what it does is when you go into science, you get into what your one area where you drill down, like looking at lizards and cystomorphism, and you get so focused. And yet the reason why you got into science was because you loved the diversity of it all, and you loved exploring the natural world, and you loved, so it lets them kind of be like a kid again and go back to exploring. And I think, I can't imagine that when I watch the kids who show up with their bug and they bring it up to a table and say, I found this, and the scientist gets all excited and tells them all about it, I can't imagine that that doesn't spark them to want to continue on in that, because there's nobody better at sharing their enthusiasm than a scientist who loves to go out and explore. And that just creates, it generates enthusiasm for the kids. So I can't imagine that it hasn't sparked that. We had at one, actually here in Wisconsin, we had a family from Indiana whose daughter was so interested in entomology, in insects, that they asked if they could come and spend the time and be part of the BioBlitz. And so we did that. And she just was so, we embedded her with the entomology team, and she tagged along. And actually the whole family benefited from it, because they got to see stuff they wouldn't see. They got to spend time. Their son was along, and he was thrilled with what he was seeing. In fact, at one point, the parents were out and the kids were in the tent sleeping. The parents were out in the middle of the night at sheets. So I think it has that potential, and I'm sure that that potential has been realized somewhere.
Right. Wow. That's incredible that you did that. Okay. So what is the structure of the staff, I would say, who work at a museum? A lot of people think, oh, it's curators, it's security, it's the administration, it's accounting, but I don't think people understand the extent to which scientists and a lot of people from the scientific community are employed through the museum.
Right. So what you often, the curator in a natural history museum, which is what we are, the curator and the scientist are one and the same. So we have, our structure is we have research scientists who are focused on research and focused on studying those collections that we have. And then we have the collection managers and the collections curators who are focused on taking care of the collections. All of them are focused on interpreting those collections too. So we have we also have digitization people in the collections area, because they are the ones who are making sure that that information and the objects, the specimens, are accessible to everyone, to scientists from around the world and to the public. We have the registrar. That's somebody who actually makes sure that we keep our records and tracks all of the records for those. You know, we have over 4 million objects in this collection, and we have to keep track of those. So that is what the registrar does. And she makes sure that we have the proper ownership of them, because some of these things come from people who donate. And so there's all this paperwork. We also, you know, the one thing that people don't think about in museums, we also have artists, because those exhibits are often built by people who have come up through the art world. And we have, you know, we have the marketing people and the social media people. And so we are a little microcosm of any organization. We just have a few more things added on to that.
Whole ecosystem. So before you left the Carnegie Museum, I want to also add, going back to all this research you did, you landed on the front page of the New York Times. And I would love for you to speak to more about what that experience was like, reflecting on all these amazing things you've done, recognition with the BioBlitz and landing on the New York Times cover.
So the New York Times article was about research that was fortuitous, in that because I'd been spending so much time on the island of Anguilla, I had lots of friends on Anguilla. And in 1995, there was a massive, massive Category 4. At that time, it was maybe the first Category 4 storm that was ever named, that came barreling through the Caribbean and went all the way. It spent a lot of time over these islands. It was slow moving, very destructive. And about a month after that, I got a message from a couple of people on the island saying, iguanas are invading the island. And my thought was, there is a species. So there are two different species of iguanas in the Caribbean. And one of them occurs on the island of Anguilla, but it's all up in ravines and things and in places where people don't live. So my thought was, well, maybe they were dispersed across the island because of the hurricane. But then somebody sent me a picture, and it was the other species of iguana. And they said they were coming in on rafts. And so I then went down to start studying this and discovered that they actually came into, the green iguana had invaded several northern Lesser Antilles, so the northern islands in the chain of islands, had invaded the island about a month after the hurricane. And in researching it and doing some genetic work on it, discovered that, in fact, they came from the island of Montserrat, which had a tremendous amount of rainfall. And I'm surmising, and it had some hillsides that were washed out to sea. And what I surmised was that these iguanas were up in the trees, washed out to sea, and came floating in. And then what we tracked them for over a year and realized that, in fact, because there were enough of them that came in, they were starting to breed on that island. And so the paper that was published in Nature showed there'd always been a question about overwater dispersal as a way that islands get populated, that that animals travel over water, but there'd never been any evidence that a large, because iguanas are big. And so you get little things that are able to survive. But this was big iguanas that survived at sea, came in, and started to actually reproduce. So it was direct evidence of overwater dispersal as a way for populating an island. And it was the first evidence of a large number of animals moving and large animals. And so that's why it made the New York Times, and it made all these kids' books. They had all these, it was fun because it's something you can understand. And visually they had all kinds of, especially these kids' books, like Ranger Rick had this, like a iguanas on a raft with a, you know, like they were setting out with, I mean, the visuals were great, but that was just because it was fortuitous. It was just because I knew people from that island and they told me, and I thought, this is something that we need to investigate.
Wow. Networking.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So you ended up returning to Milwaukee and were put in a situation where you were a part of this massive, expansive turnaround with the museum. Can you speak to more about what the situation was like when you entered and what some of the challenges were?
So when I came back to Milwaukee, it was actually in 2008, and I came back as academic dean of the museum. And the building that we're in was built in the 60s. It's a concrete block building without moisture barrier, without insulation, and it hasn't been maintained. And it's starting to fail. And so prior to me becoming president, the board determined that we needed that the building is owned by the county and the county doesn't have the resources to, it's like $100 million in deferred maintenance. County doesn't have that money to put into it. So we need to build a new museum and not have it be a county museum, have it be a, we are separate 501c3, but we operate in a county building and the county owns the collection. So that decision was made. And then the previous president left in the middle of that discussion. And I was put in the position to move this project forward. So I said, okay, this will be like my swan song, moving this project forward. And so for the last 3 years, we've been moving this forward and we have been making progress on towards that new facility.
That is just an enormous challenge to step into. Yes. And most people wouldn't have the courage to do something like that.
I'm going to tell you that the reason why I said yes is because it is the team here is phenomenal. And so it's not me moving this forward. It is the team. And we are all on the same page. And really, it takes that kind of teamwork. And if there hadn't been that team here, and there have been a few changes in the team, and we brought on other team members who are equally good, but I would not have taken it on. So it's not me moving it forward. It is the effort of the entire team. And when I say that team, it all goes all the way down. You know, it's through the course of the organization.
Hmm. So I've read in many articles, so many people characterize you as this incredibly humble person. So I want to brag about you and read off this quote someone gave, which said, "Ellen is exactly who the museum needs right now. She has the vision and the ability to execute. She knows how to lead and build a team." Can you speak more to your leadership and your ability to approach really challenging, difficult situations and your outlook, your mentality on how you're approaching these situations?
So I think that, this is not an easy thing for me to answer in that I don't feel like I know I'm leading, but I think that leading for me is surrounding yourself with people who are smarter than you and letting them run with their jobs, not giving them what they need to do their jobs, bringing them together to brainstorm. So, you know, I think early on in my career, when I was just starting to get into administration, I think I thought I needed to have the answer for everything, that it needed to come from me because I was the leader and therefore I needed to, that was what I thought leadership was. And then quickly learned that, you know, there's no way that I have all the answers. I bring together the people and I put the right people at the table for the questions. So if it's something that has to do with closing this museum for 3 days because of COVID, I've got the people on the ground floor who are the ones welcoming visitors in to get there. I've got the people who oversee security to get their input so we can make the right decision. The other side of leadership, which is, you know, you can bring all the people together and you can make those great decisions because you're getting the input. And I will say that I put off making the decision until I have to, because I think my brain thinks better at night when I'm asleep than during the day. And so I need to gather that information. And I think that everybody on the team realizes that, because I may even put up resistance to an idea and then I'll sleep on it and then I'll come back to them and say, you know what, that's a great idea. Let's do this, this, and this. But it's bringing people together, making informed decisions from listening to everybody, making sure that everybody's comfortable in really challenging. I mean, people challenge me all the time. That is a good thing. But then the other side of it is once the decision's made, I take ownership. It is mine. So if it was a bad decision, it's my bad decision. I'm not going to pass that on to somebody else and say, well, so-and-so told me to do it. It's taking that, but also taking all that information. The decisions are often made jointly in that we come to a consensus, but then it's because I'm the one at the top that I need to take ownership of it and not say we made this. I'll say we made it if it's, you know, when it's the right decision. But if it's something where there maybe it wasn't the right thing to do, then it's my responsibility.
That was fantastic. Oh, to hear. Yeah. So you hear this all the time. You should not be the quote smartest person in the room. By the way, I'm sure people are thinking like, that sounds like you. You're one of the smarter ones in the room. And even you are saying that. Yeah, she's shaking her head.
No, you know, because I just think about the people who are surrounding me. And, you know, what I would say is that every one of us has a different skill set, and we're at the top with that skill set, but you need more than one skill set to make those decisions. But honestly, I feel like I'm the one who's trailing behind the rest of my team, that they're charging ahead and I'm making sure that they have the resources. But it truly is a team effort too. And yeah, I guess it's probably just my upbringing also that says, you know, don't take credit for things that you didn't do.
There are so many leadership lessons to draw from what you just said alone. I mean, delegating, not micromanaging, allowing people to fly and providing the resources, the environment they need to succeed. I mean, that to me, that's part of the essence of demonstrating excellent leadership. I read that you have to move all these objects, 4 million objects from the current building to the new one. I mean, that's just one challenge alone. What are specifically some of the challenges that you've either encountered or are currently experiencing in this huge transition?
You know, so moving the collections is a challenge, but there are other museums that have done this, and there are the resources to help you understand how to do it. I think our biggest challenge there is getting everything digitized prior to the move so we can track. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is we can't move without knowing what we're moving. But I think that the biggest challenge for us is more so this museum. People have been coming to this is the third building we're in. Fourth, if you predate us, our collections go back pre the original building. So we were established in 1882. So it's our third actual museum building. So we've moved before, but of course we've accumulated while during that move. But we've been in this building for nearly 60 years. And people love this museum. They love the nostalgia of coming here. And so our biggest challenge really is not everything's going to the new museum, and whatever goes is not going in the same form, mm-hmm. because these exhibits, many of them were built 50 years ago, and we've learned so much more, you know, so that's just bringing people along on this journey. So that's where we've committed to a lot of input from the community as we move forward through every single step of the process. So that's where the chief planning officer is spending a lot of her time too, in workshops with community groups to let them see what excitement there could be in the new museum and kind of bring them along. So that's probably the biggest challenge, is, you know, because perception is a big part of what people perceive and what they are thinking about the new, you know, they're worried about losing what we have here.
It's a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. So I read that, and I want to quote this is very interesting, quote, in an era of misinformation, museums remain among the most trusted organizations. They play a critical role in democratizing information, science, especially, and fostering learning. And it goes on to say that, you know, showing facts in a way that involves people and offering them a deeper understanding of how did it get this way, really engages people. So I would love to hear your take on the role museums play in informing society and inspiring people. We're living in this era. This is misinformation central at this point. Left, right, up, to everywhere you look, there's a piece of information, and it's really spread into this scientific space that I don't think we've really seen in the past.
Yeah. I think it's probably been there in the past, but because of social media and more access, it's much more prevalent. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because museums are trusted because we are considered safe places to go and learn something. And, you know, we have people who come in who dispute. You know, I know that we present evolution, and there are a lot of people who come in and will do tours of museums showing how this is not accurate or true. So it happens in museums, but I think we're trusted because we're considered safe spaces. But I will say that museums are really, in a sense, undergoing an evolution too, because especially when it comes to how you present other cultures. So we present both natural history and cultural history. And if you look at, and that's what natural history museums often do. So you'll see other world cultures presented in a natural history museum, which is interesting in and of itself, because it tends to be that the white cultures get presented in a history museum, and all the other cultures are in a natural history museum, which tells you there's something wrong there. But then they're presented in kind of a static, this is the way it was, and as though they're not still thriving cultures. So museums are starting to undergo their own evolution. And so in our new museum, we've got so many different cultures in this state, and we want their stories to be told through their voices, so that we're not interpreting what their story is. Now, for our museum, because we've got natural history and cultural history collections, the new museum will really be telling the stories that lie at the intersection of nature and culture. So it's the stories that will talk about how the natural world has influenced us and influenced the way we develop, influenced the way our rituals develop, influenced because they, many of them go back to the natural world and why we did stuff. It was because of what was going on in that natural world. And then how we impact the natural world. So it will be this, and that's where we want those stories. I mean, I think about the Native American stories that, and I remember having a conversation with a member of the Red Cliff Band of the Ojibwe, and he was telling me, I said something about being a scientist, and he said, oh, science, it's so slow. And I was curious. And then I read this book by Robin Wall Kimmerer, who is a member of the Potawatomi tribe, and she's also a botanist. And she talked about, she wove together ancestral teachings and science. But she was talking about how, you know, the trees through their roots communicate with each other. And this is what the Native Americans know. And then like a year ago, a scientific paper came out on the trees communicating through their roots. And I was thinking, that's what he was talking about. It's that their knowledge, which has been gained through years and years of passing on through generations, that is a knowledge that we have to appreciate and say is equal to the knowledge that we discover through science, that there are different ways of knowing things. We have to make sure that we give those ways a voice, because they are important. They actually are what makes this diverse world really amazing. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Oh, that was, thank you for sharing that. I'm so glad you touched on that. Now, I did want to ask about how the museum has incorporated diverse perspectives and incorporated more diverse and inclusive stories as well throughout the museum's exhibits and the experience that visitors have. And yeah, you definitely touched on that. How are you thinking about that when working on this transformation of the museum?
It just comes through the direct engagement with the different community groups to make sure that they are heard and that they're, we also, you know, we're talking as we haven't settled in, but there probably will be community curated spaces in the new museum and areas where, again, we can bring together in a safe environment people to have discussions about hard topics. But that's what we want to do, is provide to be that community resource and a safe place to go to have discussions that might not be that easy.
You've published 3 books, over 50 articles. You developed this incredible BioBlitz program. You are leading this museum during one of the most transformative moments in its history. Conducted groundbreaking research. All your resume is filled with these incredible accomplishments. But to you, what are you most proud of?
You know, I would have to say that BioBlitz is really the one that I just feel like it melds together science and community engagement and excitement about the natural world. It's just such a positive event. And that's the one that every time I go to one, I just get reinvigorated by it. I remember one of the first ones we did in Connecticut, one of the butterfly people, when he was talking about what they'd found, he said, you know, turning a bunch of scientists loose in a park like this to do this is like turning a bunch of kids loose in Toys R Us. It's like this. And that's what I think it gets everybody back to what really inspired them to go into this line of work. And then it also can transfer that excitement to kids so that they think about going into this. And it's just amazing when you come up with, I think our highest was over 2,000 species in a park in 24 hours.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I think that's probably the one that I'm most proud of.
What would you say to young people, young women listening to this podcast who aspire to become a scientist or are pursuing a career in STEM? What would you tell them?
I would tell them to keep your mind open, grab at opportunities that you think where you're thinking, that's not what I thought I would be doing. Do it, because I never set out to do what I'm doing right now. I didn't, you know, I set out, my initial was to be a vet. And then all of a sudden I got inspired by a TA who was doing research on lions in Africa. And I thought, wow, somebody can do that. And then that set me off. And each point, a new opportunity opened up, and it wasn't necessarily where I thought I was headed, but it brought me here. And I would also say, you know, I mean, I didn't say flippantly, oh, I'm going to do that. I thought long and hard. But when I made the decision, the other thing I would say is never doubt your decision and never look back and say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Just keep going, because you can't change it. So therefore, you should just make sure that you keep thinking of it in that positive way, because you didn't make the decision. Everybody makes these decisions with a lot of thought. You know, keep yourself open to doing something different. I mean, it's easy to get caught in a rut and not want to change. And I think it's almost human nature to not change. But there are so many exciting opportunities if you just keep yourself open to change.
Amazing advice. We always wrap our podcast episodes with this question. If you could leave our listeners with one lasting piece of advice, what would that be?
I think that would be that keep, you know, stay open to change and keep the sense of wonder. Keep curiosity as part of your, all the way into your 90s. Be curious about this world, because it's an amazing place to live. And I know that we're dealing with a lot of hard things right now. But it is an amazing planet. And be curious about it.
Dr. Ellen Senske, thank you so much for all of your wisdom and for coming on this podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to an episode of Redefining Ambition. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe, rate us, tell your friends, and if there's anyone you think we should have on our show, let me know. Join me next Tuesday for a brand new episode of Redefining Ambition. We'll see you all then. Take care, everyone.